Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 24th of January, these are our main stories. In New Hampshire, Nikki Haley, the remaining challenger to Donald Trump for the Republican nomination for the US presidency, is upbeat.
Donald Trump, he's good at breaking things, but you gotta have somebody that can fix things too. And that's the situation we're in. We got a lot to fix.
But Donald Trump's supporters are confident their man will win big. Also, the Turkish parliament finally ratifies Sweden's bid to join NATO. As Argentina prepares for a general strike, we have a profile of the controversial new president, Javier Milei.
He talks to a dog that's been dead for 6 or 7 years. He also says that the dead dog communicates with God, and that God was the one who told him that he would be president. His clone dogs are the ones that advise him on political decisions.
Also in this podcast, the murder rate in Haiti has more than doubled in the last 12 months amid the rise in gang violence. And the wildlife park with feathered friends that have become infamous.
Are the relentless swearing parrots. So I will try my hardest to make sure that I disguise anything that they say, but I am very close to them. But I don't think they'll swear while I've got a telephone in my hand.
So can the potty-mouthed parrots be taught to swear just a little less? In the United States, people in New Hampshire are voting in primaries to choose their candidate for this year's presidential election. The former president, Donald Trump, is facing off against the former U.S. ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, his only remaining rival in the race for the Republican nomination. Mr. Trump made a surprise visit to a polling station in the town of Londonderry.
I'm very confident. I mean, this is it. Look, this is, we just stopped here. We stopped at a polling site. We picked it at random. We may stop at one more. And nobody knew we were coming. This is pretty amazing.
Mr. President, Haley says that she's staying in through Super Tuesday.
I don't care.
Is she a threat to you?
No, and I don't care if she stays in. Let her do whatever she wants. It doesn't matter.
But Nikki Haley insists she offers an alternative to Mr. Trump.
Donald Trump is young. He's good at breaking things. But you got to have somebody that can fix things, too. And that's the situation we're in. We got a lot to fix.
It's not the party uniting around President Trump. It's the political elite that are uniting around President Trump. And the political elite had never been with me my entire career because I've always fought the political elite.
Our North America correspondent Gary O'Donoghue is in New Hampshire and spoke to Valerie Tanderson.
You can hear the door banging. I'm sure it's the door of the polling station. I'm sat in Manchester, Ward 8, which is New Hampshire's largest city. And people have got another couple of hours to vote here. And if they're an undeclared voter, an undecided voter in that sense, they can choose to vote into the Republican or the Independent or the Democratic primary. And, you know, what we've seen really is this coming down to two people, Donald Trump and Nikki Haley, you heard from there. And Donald Trump has, in the polls at least, a commanding lead. And today is really all about seeing how big that victory will be and whether or not, given the size of that victory we're all expecting, whether or not Nikki Haley can stay in any longer in this race.
And it's everything to play for her, isn't it? Because if she doesn't win this, will she throw in the towel?
Well, I think it's a very long shot for her to win here. I mean, New Hampshire does provide upsets, so it's possible, but she's looking at double-digit gaps in the polling. Now, polls are polls, votes are different. So she will want to narrow that to single digits, perhaps, get into the 40s. That would be something that would be a strong finish as far as she's concerned, and that's the word she's been using. Because the next big test is South Carolina, and that's her home state. She was governor there for 2 terms, popular governor, but she's trailing hugely. And so she'll have a very big decision to make after New Hampshire. Does she want to run the risk of losing in her own home state, or does she want to pull out before then? It's a big, difficult decision for her, but she believes there's still something in this race, and when it comes down to two people like this, it is a very stark choice.
Now, you're there, you've been talking to people. I mean, what is the appeal of Donald Trump? Why is he so popular?
I was thinking about this today, and I think it comes down to the word strength. It's the thing you hear over and over again from his supporters. Yeah, sure, they mention different policies like immigration. They mention China. Sometimes they mention the economy. But it's the words strong and strength that come a lot. And it's because he does project that sort of image. And that's what certainly 30 or 40% of the electorate constantly find attractive.
Gary O'Donoghue in New Hampshire, and we'll be bringing you those results on the Global News podcast later. The Turkish Parliament has ratified Sweden's bid to join NATO by an overwhelming majority in a long-delayed vote. President Erdogan is expected to sign the legislation. Turkey had blocked the Nordic country's membership, accusing it of hosting Kurdish militants, which it designates as terrorists. Our chief international correspondent, Orla Girin, is in Istanbul.
It's been a long, complicated road to get this far. It's almost 2 years since Sweden applied for membership of NATO, and of course all the member countries have to agree. Turkey put up a series of roadblocks. In particular, President Erdogan was objecting to Sweden being, as he saw it, too lenient on members of groups on Swedish soil that Turkey regards as terrorists, for example, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. Now, he demanded and got a change in Sweden. The country amended its constitution and tightened its anti-terrorism laws. So that solved one of President Erdogan's demands. But he has also linked agreeing Sweden joining NATO to the White House going ahead with the sale of F-16 fighter jets to Ankara. That had been delayed for some time, but President Erdogan seems to believe that this will now go ahead now that he has stopped blocking NATO's expansion. That would leave Hungary as the last remaining NATO member, which has not given its approval. There are some indications that Hungary and Turkey had been coordinating their stance on this, and there was an indication of progress with the Hungarian Prime Minister suddenly inviting his Swedish counterpart to come to Hungary for negotiations on the issue. So I would expect Hungary to fall into line on this quite soon, and for the expansion to go ahead, an expansion that was forced on Sweden by Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which forced the country to abandon its decades-long policy of neutrality.
Orla Girin in Turkey. The head of the UN, Antonio Guterres, says the rejection of a two-state solution to the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians by the highest levels of Israel's government is unacceptable. Mr. Guterres was speaking at a UN Security Council meeting in New York.
Last week's clear and repeated rejection of the two-state solution at the highest level of the Israeli government is unacceptable. This refusal and the denial of the right to statehood to the Palestinian people would indefinitely prolong a conflict that has become a major threat to global peace and security. The right of the Palestinian people to build their own fully independent state must be recognized by all, and any refusal to accept the two-state solution by any party must be firmly rejected.
In Gaza, Israeli tanks have surrounded the southern city of Khan Yunis. Palestinians say their only route out of the intense fighting there has been blocked, effectively leaving them trapped. The Hamas-run health ministry says Israeli soldiers fired directly at the Nasser hospital complex in the city, but the Israeli army is yet to respond. Speaking via video at a news conference in Geneva, the World Health Organization spokesman Christian Lindmeier said those at the hospital complex are facing a dire situation.
It must be a horrible scenario on the ground there with people not knowing what the next minutes will bring. And additionally, the situation of not having enough food, water, or the medical supplies. 20 hospitals are not functioning. It's all over Gaza. The patients and people seeking safety within these facilities, not only are they now at risk, but also newly injured people are being prevented to reach the hospital and come in. Absolutely unacceptable and not what any health facility anywhere in the world should go through.
Striking a defiant note once again, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed the war would not stop until his country achieved total victory against Hamas. Despite this tough talk, the White House confirmed that a top US official, Brett McGurk, is in the Middle East for talks about a new pause in the fighting. Here's the National Security Council spokesman John Kirby.
Brett is in the region. He was in Cairo today, as a matter of fact, and he'll have other stops along the way. Certainly one of the things he's in the region talking about is the potential for another hostage deal, which would require a humanitarian pause of some length to get that done. And that's definitely on the agenda. He'll also be talking about a range of other issues, including humanitarian assistance, getting assessment of Israeli Defense Force operations and the protection of civilian life. I mean, there's a lot on his agenda.
We've been hearing more from our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
There's definitely a sense of momentum happening. We heard before the announcement about Brett McGurk that a Hamas group is in Cairo as well for talks. And Qatar, which has played a big role in mediation with Egypt and with the US, has been talking things up as well, saying that they're receiving lots of dialogue from both sides, which they're saying is, you know, a very good thing. I mean, the problem is that there's still, at least publicly, a huge divide between what the Israeli government is prepared to accept and what Hamas is prepared to accept on the other side. We had a leaked report yesterday saying that Israel had come up with a potential plan for a two-month ceasefire, which would see a staged release of all the hostages that are still held. And through that, a large number of Palestinian prisoners would also be released. Now, we haven't had that confirmed officially. We've also haven't had an official response from Hamas to the report, but there have been signs, indications that Hamas is not accepting that premise, but that would be where the deal goes. I mean, Hamas has publicly said throughout that it is only going to give up all the hostages that it still holds for a complete end of the Israel offensive in Gaza and a complete withdrawal of Israeli troops, and essentially allowing Hamas leaders, those who survive, to remain in Gaza, not to go into exile, as this leaked proposal has been suggesting.
Sebastian Usher. Campaigners in Serbia have called for all maternity hospitals to allow pregnant women to be accompanied during childbirth. It follows an alleged assault on a Roma mother in hospital in the town of Sremska Mitrovica, in which her newborn child died. The woman said the doctor jumped on her stomach and insulted her ethnicity. Dode Jovanovic is president of the European Roma Rights Centre and is himself Serbian. He spoke to Tim Franks.
Though deeply distressing, this is not a unique situation. This is just like illustration of the childbirth-related violence and discrimination that is widely spread in state hospitals in Serbia. And her experience shed light on systematic issues with the healthcare system that disproportionately affects marginalized communities such as Roma. You can see that she very bravely shared her story on social media, seeking to raise awareness. And then you could see how this resonated and many other women started to come out and saying about the very similar situation they were experiencing in the hospitals. And in particular, in this one hospital, there was like public protests in Serbia in support to what happened to her.
Or would you say it's a nationwide phenomenon?
It's a nationwide, very old phenomenon, which is not correctly addressed now for centuries, you know. And it's not just Serbia, it's Europe as a continent. If you look at the reports from NGOs, but also from Fundamental Rights Agency, you could read in their reports that discrimination against Roma is widespread and accessing healthcare in particular, but in other areas. Like just a decade ago, we had very terrible cases of forced sterilization of Romani women in Czech Republic. And that also shows how serious this systematic discrimination is.
Jorde Jovanovic, president of the European Roma Rights Centre. Frank Farian, the German singer and music producer who founded the hugely successful disco group Boney M, has died at his home in Miami. He was 82. Frank Farian formed the band in 1976, which went on to sell millions of records worldwide. Our entertainment correspondent Lizo Mazimba reports.
Frank Farian was more than just the producer who founded Boney M. He also sang the male vocals on all their hit records. She's crazy like a fool. While the group's frontman Bobby Farrell lip-synced to his voice. There was a certain man in Russia long ago. He was In the 1970s, the band had 9 top 10 singles, including 2 number ones. Frank Farian believed their success was down to their music having a timeless quality.
Boney M is evergreen. They have a lot of evergreen songs. Maris Bolger, Rivers of Babylon. From east to west, from west to east, you can go everywhere, you listen Boney M music, still.
Born in southwestern Germany, Frank Farian trained as a chef while pursuing a musical career, first as a singer and then as a producer. And he worked with stars ranging from Meatloaf to Stevie Wonder. I just called. He became embroiled in controversy when he repeated his winning formula of putting together a group which lip-synced to songs actually recorded by others. Girl, you know it's true. For years, fans of Milli Vanilli believed it was them performing, and they became one of the most successful acts of the late 80s. But they were later stripped of their Grammy Award for Best New Act when it was publicly revealed that neither of the 2 members of the group actually sang on any of their hits. Still, over the years, Frank Farian sold hundreds of millions of records, cementing his reputation as one of music's most successful producers. By the rivers of Babylon.
Lise Omer-Zimber on the life of Frank Farian, who has died at the age of 82. Still to come on the Global News podcast, what has caused a sharp rise in measles across Europe?
It's down to the COVID pandemic. Between 2019 and 2022, there was a quite steep fall off in vaccination rates in children.
The United Nations says the number of homicides in Haiti more than doubled in 2023. The new figures put Haiti among the most deadly countries in the world. Here's our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
A report by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says that almost 4,800 people were murdered last year. Mr. Guterres said that he was appalled by the worsening level of violence. Security has deteriorated sharply since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse in 2021, which has led to unprecedented levels of lawlessness and violence. Haiti's powerful criminal gangs control as much as 80% of the capital, Port-au-Prince. An international security force led by Kenyan police and backed by the UN is expected to arrive in the next few months to try to restore order.
There's been what is being called an alarming increase in cases of measles across Europe, according to the World Health Organization. More than 42,000 infections were reported by member states in 2023, compared to 941 in 2022, a 45-fold increase. Health chiefs are warning that cases are still rising and say urgent measures are needed to prevent any further spread. Our health reporter Philippa Roxby told Valerie Sanderson what has caused this. Surge.
The World Health Organization are saying it's down to the COVID pandemic. Between 2019 and 2022, they can see that there was a quite steep fall off in vaccination rates in children. There's a measles jab called the MMR. Normally, about 95% of children have to be fully immunized against measles for it not to spread. But they can see that during the pandemic, that fell to around 93-92%. It doesn't seem a big fall, but that's enough because measles is a highly contagious virus. That's enough for it to start spreading again.
So what are health experts recommending to stop the spread?
Vaccination for children and adults. Whoever has missed out on doses of this very effective vaccine called the MMR, they want to catch up campaigns in countries across Europe and detecting outbreaks quickly so that they can stamp on it. Really, the only way to solve this issue, health experts say, is to get more people vaccinated. It's got to be up to that really high level of around 95%, which is the target from the WHO.
Is there any resistance to vaccination with the MMR vaccine? Because it was very unpopular at the turn of the century, wasn't it?
Around 25 years ago, there was a study published completely falsely claiming it was linked to autism in children. That has been completely debunked, that theory. But unfortunately, it did hit parents' confidence in the vaccine. So at the time, some children missed out. Then vaccination rates recovered. But there are lots of reasons why people may be missing out. The pandemic was one of them. People didn't go and get their vaccinations as normal, apart from the ones against COVID. And surgeries and health clinics were closed and people didn't go to hospitals. But there is some anti-vaccine sentiment around. And also people are just sometimes struggling to get through to their local family doctor, struggling to get a convenient appointment in their busy lives. And sometimes it's lower down their list of priorities. And that's an issue as well. People haven't seen measles, which can be a very deadly disease. And so they forget about it and they forget that it's a threat.
Philippa Roxby. Unions in Argentina have called a general strike on Wednesday in protest at a sweeping set of new laws designed to cut public spending, reduce employment protections and pave the way for the privatisation of state industries. Those radical measures, introduced by the new president Javier Milei, are aimed at reducing the worst level of inflation in Latin America, more than 200% last year. And that has pushed almost half the country into poverty. James Menendez in Buenos Aires has been taking a closer look at Javier Milei.
On a dusty pitch in a working-class suburb of Buenos Aires, a small group of young footballers have been put through their paces. They're training for Chacarita Juniors, the team that Javier Milei joined as a young teenager. He was the goalkeeper, pretty fearless by all accounts, but also unassuming, according to his coach at the time, Eduardo Greco, who 40 years later still runs things around here.
He was a very dedicated boy, very focused on training. He was not used to being in large groups, quite withdrawn, and kept a low profile.
Greco says he was genuinely surprised when it became clear that Milei had a real chance of rising to the very top of Argentine politics. He also told me, incidentally, that the young goalie used to have neat blonde hair and that, in fact, he was brought up in a solidly middle-class household. Towards the end of his time at school, he formed a Rolling Stones cover band. This was his favourite song. Everest, as they were known, were together for 6 months. They only performed twice in public. Milei was Mick Jagger, his friend Hernan Borrachia was drummer Charlie Watts, and on a poor phone line from Spain, he told me that Milei loved the limelight.
He started out doing a parody of Mick Jagger, but then he ended up actually becoming him. He came up with all the elements and put together the show. It was incredible. He was unique.
He also had a unique style when he started to teach economics as a postgraduate student. Appalled by the hyperinflation of a previous economic crisis in Argentina, he became obsessed with libertarian ideas about shrinking the state and untrammelled free markets. Franco Pino was in one of his classes.
I was struck by his hairstyle. The time I had him as a professor, I was very glad because he came with very different ideas.
And it was those radical views and the rock star styling that got him noticed by TV and radio producers who began booking him as a pundit for discussion programmes. Audiences, or at least some of them, lapped up his increasingly abrasive style. He once called a former mayor of Buenos Aires a socialist piece of, you can guess what, and Pope Francis, who's from Argentina, a donkey and an ignoramus. And the more famous he became, the more extreme his behaviour. Just 2 years after getting elected as an MP, he was thrust onto the presidential campaign trail, promising to slash the number of government ministries by half. Pledges like this got him noticed, but so did reports of Milei's increasingly eccentric behaviour. He said that the only two constants in his life are his sister and his dogs, five English mastiffs cloned from his first canine friend, Conan, who died a few years ago. Juan Luis González is author of a biography of Javier Milei called El Loco, or The Madman. Is he?
I don't know if he is crazy in clinical terms, but as a journalist, what I can say is that he says he talks to a dog that's been dead for 6 or 7 years. He also says that the dead dog communicates with God, and that God was the one who told him that he would be president in 2023. And also that his clone dogs are the ones that advise him on political decisions. So I think there must be a clinical case there.
Juan tells me he's a lot like Donald Trump. He is impossible to ignore. And more than half the country voted for him, hoping, desperately, he is the one to turn this country around. That is a tall order for anyone.
James Menendez reporting from Buenos Aires. Let's take you back to 1940s Hollywood now, when the US government began to single out those it accused of being communist sympathisers. It became known as the Red Scare. Hundreds of directors, actors and producers were blacklisted, never able to work in the industry again. Among them, Orson Welles, Leonard Bernstein and Charlie Chaplin. Well, the first of a 10-part podcast called Hollywood Exiles, that's now on the BBC World Service, and it's narrated by Charlie Chaplin's granddaughter, Una. Rob Young asked the producer, Glyn Tansley, how interested was she in shining a light on this period?
She really was. This was in the wake of the Second World War. There was this divide in the United States. Charlie Chaplin was one of the biggest stars in the world. He was at a level of fame and celebrity that is hard to compare to today, really. And so we went to Una, who is an actor in her own right. People might know her from programmes like Game of Thrones. And she was really interested. She didn't know a huge amount about this era. She didn't know about him being forced out of the United States. And we realised quite early on when Una was involved that to understand what happened to all of these people, you really had to understand who they were and where they had come from. And so we started the journey with Una at the kind of beginning of Charlie Chaplin's story in South London, in Kennington. And we went to a cinema museum in South London. And we have a little clip to play you, where we basically take her to this museum and she discovers that it has a hidden history that she wasn't aware of.
This building is imposing and beautiful. And as we'd been approaching, I'd wondered what it had been before. What was its history? I was stunned to find out.
You may be surprised to learn that this building started life as the Lambeth Workhouse, and your grandfather was here several times as a child.
Working here?
Yeah.
Wow.
His childhood was very poverty-stricken.
Right.
And so, Glyn, what sort of an impact did the Red Scare have on Chaplin then? And how did he deal with it? How did he respond?
Well, it had a huge effect on him. I mean, one of the things we find out in this first episode, which is available now, is he was actually the very first person in Hollywood who was accused of being a communist. It goes back as far as 1922, his FBI file. And that FBI file builds up through the 1940s, through the 1950s. He's put on trial for crimes he didn't commit. His name is dragged through the mud in the gossip columns. And eventually he is forced to leave the United States. Una spoke to her mum, Geraldine Chaplin, who's also an actor, and she remembers being on the boat with her dad and mum when they left the United States, never to return. She was too young to remember that, but years later, she did ask her dad about... She found out in school and she went home and she asked him about being a communist, and we have that clip to play you as well.
I asked, Daddy, is it true you can't go back to the States because you're a communist? He's, I'm not a communist. Look at the way we live. I'm not a communist. We lived in this enormous house, which is now a museum. Having lived in such abject poverty when he was a child really left its mark on him. But that, you saw it in a movie, and if you defend the underdog, you're a commie. He had friends who were communists, he had friends who were whatever. But I think that terrible poverty leave its mark and you'll become someone who defends the underdog.
Una and Geraldine Chaplin talking about Charlie Chaplin in Hollywood Exiles, which is on the BBC World Service now. Well, now to something a little different, a set of foul-mouthed African grey parrots who were segregated from others because they swore too much in front of visitors are being put back with other parrots at a wildlife park here in England. The hope is that their language gets less offensive. Steve Nichols is the chief executive who runs the park in Lincolnshire. Michelle Hussein asked him just how bad their language was.
It is very, very bad. It's a lot worse than what I could actually tell you. You can rest assured I'll not be saying anything. However, I am in earshot of, there's about a dozen around me, and I know I can see that two of them are the relentless swearing parrots. So I will try my hardest to make sure that I disguise anything that they say, but I am very close to them. But I don't think they'll swear while I've got the telephone in my hand.
Well, we can all hope. But someone must have taught them, right? Who did they pick this up from?
No. Basically, what's happened, it's a strange thing. African greys are by far the best at repeating people's words. And when people have them as a pet, as a fun thing to do, the majority of people teach them some unusual words. And the good thing about it is you can tell exactly what it is that's actually taught them because they replicate the voice. They don't only say the word. So if it's a gentleman that's done it, they come in a gentleman's voice. And it is the actual gentleman's voice who's donating the bird to the sanctuary. Or if it's a lady, it's exactly the same as the lady. So what they can't do is they can't come and say, my husband's taught him to swear, and then he swears in the lady's voice, because you'll guarantee that's who's taught it. And once they do teach them, you can't help but laugh. I've been doing this 35 years, and when I walk past an aviary and a parrot swears at me, I still laugh now. It's impossible not to laugh. And they think that's a positive reaction, so they just do it more.
But you had them in a kind of foul-mouthed corner of the park. Why have you changed your mind?
Well, the idea is because we've had another three that's come now. So we've got eight, and we just finished constructing a new enclosure where we've just moved 92. So we've got quite a large colony of African greys, so we split them into two. And we've just moved 92 together. So we said what we'll do is put all 92 with the eight, and hopefully all the noises that you can hear in the background now, the lovely whistles and the sounds, with the odd microwave thrown in and the odd vehicle reversing noise, we're hoping they're going to teach the eight that kind of vocabulary rather than the other way around with parrots.
How do you know the other way around is not going to happen? Although I have to say, this can't have been bad for visitor numbers, the original foul-mouthed corner and now this.
Telling you the truth, it's a phenomenal thing that's happened. We don't know why. I think it's just nice every now and then to have a light-hearted story against all the heavy stories that's going in the news. And since 2020, every single month, we've had a call from somewhere around the world without fail. And it's just going around the world all the time, constantly, where people will call and say, how's the birds doing? Have they stopped swearing? And unfortunately, no, they'll never stop swearing. We just want them to swear less. But in all honesty, the actual visitors are coming to hear them. We've got signs in front of the aviaries to try to stop them.
There you go. We'll see what happens. That's Steve Nichols speaking to Michelle Hussain about the potty-mouthed parrots at Lincolnshire Wildlife Park in England. And that is it from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi, and until next time, goodbye.